accession number 11206, rail 9.
Mr. T. Thornthwaite, Reel 9. When and where did you rejoin the battalion in the Canal Zone, Mr. Thornthwaite?
Well, I think it was about June when I was still at the Octu on the staff there. And I remember the battalion had come down from the Western Desert, from Capuzzo, and they had a lot of casualties, and they were sort of collecting all members of the Durhams from all over Egypt. They were in different positions and jobs and things, and we all collected. And I joined the battalion on the station at Cairo when it came down, and we were on our way to Syria. There was a lot of strange faces that I hadn't recognised because I'd been away from the battalion for about 10 months. But a lot of strange faces there amongst the old, and a lot of faces missing that ask about so-and-so, a chap called Atkinson, Jackie Beach, Waterson, and a few that was in my platoon that got killed by bombing at Mirza Matru. So anyway, I joined the battalion there, and we went on to Syria to relieve the Australians in Syria.
What was the mood of the battalion when you joined it? Do you recall?
The mood. Well, the lads were very pleased that they got down from the desert and going to Syria. The greenery, and it was a bit different from the Western Desert, and the rationing and the food was a lot better. In Cairo, picked up rations and stuff like that, so we did live better. We didn't live so bad in Syria because we could buy stuff from the local people around. There were still farms, and that way you could go and get something to eat from them. As far as the action goes in Syria, there was very little action other than shelling. We were shelled from the Vichy French. We gradually moved up through Syria. And then things quietened down. We got as far as Aleppo. And I remember when we moved into Aleppo, the RAF had only bombed it the day before, and we weren't made very welcome by the civilians. They're very hostile to us because there was a lot of damage by the bombs. The few little cafes there was open, and we went in, but they were reluctant to serve us with anything. We're there about a week, I think it was about a week or something like that. I remember there's still some Australians there. There was a hotel in Aleppo, still open, and in the foyer was a pond with goldfish in. And these Australians, when they were drinking the local drink we called Zibib, which is Mastika or Pono, the call here now, you put water in, it turns white. They were drinking that. Well, we were told not to drink it, but they were drinking it, and before you knew, they were diving in this pond down to catch the goldfish, and they tell them, right mess of the place.
Did you come across any Vichy Frenchmen at all?
No, never actually come up against them. We seemed to be just behind them all the way. We moved into an old camp in Aleppo belonging to the French had been in. It was a barracks, actually. And all the barracks that fouled all the floors, excreted all over the shop and really made a mess of it so that we couldn't use the barracks. It was such a dirty state. We had to bed down outside with the blankets outside on the ground. I think I said that we stayed there 7 days. I think it must have been a bit longer because we did a bit training there, reorganised the battalion, and we got some reinforcements again to make the battalion up a little. And then we moved on further north. My company, D Company, I think it was D Company, we moved up to the Turkish border itself, to a little place called Idlib. And the object of being there was to accept British and Australian troops who had escaped from Greece and had come through Turkey and coming into our positions on Idlib, on the border. And I think I mentioned somewhere in the past where we had quite a lot of civilian, a lot of the Durhams employed in Turkey in civilian clothes. They were driving trucks and all kinds. The idea being that the suspected Jerry might have tried to come through Syria in through Turkey into Syria. So they had a nucleus of a force there already to accept us if we had to go in and join up with them.
This was in Turkey. There was
actually in Turkey.
Troops dressed as civilians doing work in Turkey.
They were dressed as civilians. We didn't know at the time why they took so many people away at Ismailia when we came from China to Ismailia. They took these people away and they issued them as civilians, and we didn't know what was happening at the time, but that was really what they were doing. They were in, and I have met people since, after the war, who were actually there, and they said they were driving trucks in Turkey in civilian clothes.
They didn't say how they got away with it. How did it happen? Did you ever ask them?
No, they just said that they were taken over there. Some went by aircraft, I think. Where they landed, I don't know. But that was the object of a nucleus in there. In the event of Germany trying to come through Turkey, we would immediately move in and build up on their positions and their information and everything else. They eventually came out and joined with us when we left Syria and we come back. I think altogether we were there about a month. About a month. And then we started back again, coming withdrawn right through. Now, at this point, for some reason, I joined the carrier platoon. I don't know why. I joined the carriers. And we came from the Turkish border through Syria, Jordan, Palestine, in carriers. And our carrier platoon, the platoon commander, was a chap called Sibright, Lieutenant Sibright from Durham. Now, he was eventually killed in Kos as a captain. He went out because at one time I was his driver with a jeep when I was with the battalion, and he went out at Kos in front of the position of the battalion to see what was happening, and he was fired on and the jeep turned over and he was killed, and he's buried in Rhodes, in a cemetery in Rhodes there with Major Bush, another officer of the Durhams. But as I say, we moved through with carriers, and I always remember coming through Jordan and the carriers. We had two pieces of stick up and a piece of string across, and I was hanging me dirty washing up to dry coming along the roads in Jordan, your vests and underpants. I don't know what it looked like to the civilians, but eventually we came into the canal zone again. We'd been travelling in these carriers and were filthy a couple of weeks travelling. And when we got the canal zone, we, without taking our clothes off, with shirts and shorts, we just dived straight in the canal and swam around in the canal and washed with shirts and at the same time. And then we put the carriers on flat carts, railway things, flat wagons. You drove them on. And then we moved through Cairo with them and up to the Alexander, I think it was.
What date was this, Mr. Thornthwaite?
Well, I should imagine then it'd be about the middle of October. because we went to a transit camp just outside Alexandria, and we started being re-equipped, and we got reinforcements to make the battalion up to strength again. We got equipment and everything. And then we went down to the docks. This will be the back end of October. We went down to the docks at Alex. We didn't know where we were going, but each company went on to a destroyer. And I don't know, a destroyer with a crew, there's not a lot of room to start with, and you put 100 men with all the equipment on and amongst them, and there's no accommodation, there's no where we could go. We just told to make ourselves comfortable anywhere on the boat other than on the captain on the bridge. Yeah, we're spread all around. As I say, our company went on this destroyer, which I thought was the Sikh. I might be wrong, but the... and then we moved out from Alex, moved out to the five destroyers. It was a 36-hour run from Alex to Tobruk.
And at this time, you still didn't know where you were going?
No, we didn't know where we were going. We weren't told anything.
There was no guesses as to where you might be going?
No, we never thought about Tobruk, but we knew it was somewhere up the desert on the coast, because they wouldn't have had us all on destroyers and all the rest of it. It's a 36-hour. Well, the RAF fighters could give us cover for so far up, and then there was a gap, 2 hours of daylight left when the RAF left us. That was the limit. And then there was 2 hours of daylight before darkness when we got bombed. A machine gun by Jerry fighters used to come in. Bombers and 88 Stukas used to come over.
Did they cause any casualties?
Hmm?
Did they cause any casualties?
No, not going up. I remember I told you, I says we had to get anywhere we could. Well, when a destroyer, when you get away out to sea, it's very much cold with no protection. You're not protected by shields or nothing, and you were exposed. Well, the klaxon went on the destroyer, and all the Navy crew started coming up to the different positions. One chap went to these bank of torpedo tubes, and he started manipulating them round, and as soon as they started moving, there was heads coming up between them. It was our lads was laying down between the torpedo tubes anyway, and the Navy just tore their hair out and gave up. They couldn't operate the ship because our people was everywhere. We're in the road, couldn't get moved. We didn't have any casualties going up. And then I think then somebody told us where we were going, to a port. We didn't say Tobruk. We were going to a port up the western, up the desert. It was pitch black, and you could hear the engines of the destroyer slowing down, and we started moving into the coast. And we see little blue lights, just tiny little lights, and people's voices all over. And we came in, and there was ships sunk on the side, and we pulled up alongside one of these boats. There was dozens and dozens of people standing on these upturned boats waiting to come on the destroyer. They were Australian wounded. There were bandages, and there were stretchers and all kinds. And we got off the destroyer, climbed over these wrecks, and then the wounded were taken onto the destroyers, and they returned back on the night run back to Alexandria. Obviously then we knew we were in Tobruk, because everybody there was telling us, all the old hands in the dark were saying, you're for it now, and all the rest of it, you're in Tobruk.
Was there any fighting or bombardment going on at the time?
No, it was all quiet. And it surprised the people who had been there a bit, because they said Bardia Bill will open up any time. He always does now at this time of night. Bardia was about 18, 20 mile or something, 15, 20 mile away. And there was a big German gun there. He used to shell Tobruk Harbour when he thought at night in the dark when boats would be coming in, submarines unloading stores and things like that. Right, we got on to the dry land. There was Australian guides there for us, and they took us away, and we went into this like a
wadi, was it?
The wadi. Went in the wadi. That was right. And they said, you'll find up on the side of the wadi, you'll find lots of caves and all these sort of things. It says, get yourself in there, find the one, and stay there for the night. The our company, and then the rest moved in different parts.
What was your feelings once you knew you were in Tobruk? What was your initial reaction?
Well,
of you personally.
Personally, I got into my state of mind in my head. I couldn't care where I was, to tell you the truth. I had an overcoat on, and I was tired with travelling all day, and bad head, and I just followed like sheep, wherever it says, go here, go there, and I couldn't care less. All I wanted to do was get my head down, and I remember I found this hole in the side of the wadi, and I climbed in and got down, and then, believe it or not, it rained during the night. And the reason why this was a cave was because there was a stream of water coming through it, and that's what made the hollow, and I got soaked in this thing. There it, in the morning when it got light, we came out and down onto the level. The Australians, there was about four Australians there, and they'd had a great big 50-gallon drum, oil drum, with the top off, and they were cooking that stuff in their porridge or some blooming thing, all mixed up, and had it on this fire and the doings. And they shouted, come down if you wanted. So we went down. We had our mess tins and they had big scoops, and they says, right, get in the line. So we got in the line, and they were digging into this scoop, and there was a mixture of bully beef, biscuits, custard powder, there was all kinds amongst it. Put it on, and somebody mentioned that the custard was in with the stew, and he says, well, you're all going down the same way. He says, you haven't got any more utensils, so we'll put it all together. The officers, which is normal in the battalion, the officers all stood with one side until the men was fed. There was a thing was always done at Durham's. And the Aussies shouted over, you lot over there, if you want anything to eat, you better get in the queue. No good standing there. So the officers got in the queue. Unfortunately, the officers had china plates. The batman had carried a plate and given me his plate. And I remember seeing the first one came up to the Aussie with this big ladle, and he hit the plate and it just disintegrated. And the officer was standing looking at the half a plate. And the Aussie says, come on, next. You know, he says, next. They were crude lot, the Aussies. They had no respect for officers, not like the British Army. But in the desert, actually, they were very good, you know. But they had to like the officer before they would obey him. They didn't do it because he was an officer, just because they liked him. And then we got fed, and then we were told that we're going to go up to the front line that night to relieve the Australians in the front line. Some old Italian trucks came along. I forget what this were, great big open things. So we told to pile in, and they were open. We piled in, sitting there, and you couldn't get another one in. There must have been about 40 in the back of this truck, and it was like an old slip. It was hanging down at the back and everything. And when it got dark, we moved off. And it's about 6 miles from the port area up to the frontier, the front line. And we seemed to be going for hours and hours, because we're only going very, very slow in the dark, and the shell holes, and half the road was burned. And
was it still pretty quiet at this time?
Yes, this was at this was about 8 o'clock at night.
Had you received any shelling during the day whilst you were in the port area?
Nothing. No. We were very lucky that way. So, as we moved in, we moved up towards the front line. We must have been about 200 or 300 yards away, and then they did start shelling a bit. There's mortar bombs and shells coming over, and then it quietened down. So we had to get out the trucks and start walking, following these Australian guides. And I always remember, I couldn't see any wire, and we come and he says, right, this is it. And we looked around, we were on the flat desert. You couldn't understand it. And then a bloke put his head up. actually the positions were taken over from the Australians were the Italian positions before when they were in Tobruk, and they were all concrete underground, and they only had a 2-foot aperture to go down and a metal ladder, and you come into your positions, and then you went along to the spurs, and you had the gun emplacements out there, but you had 20 blokes sleeping underground in these concrete things.
So these were concrete. What kind of height had they?
They're about, you could walk about. It must be about 6 foot. About 6 foot, you could walk about. And they were illuminated by a tin of oil or margarine with a bit of rag stuck in it, and just that was the illumination. And of course, everything was black with the ceiling with the of these places with the oil burning all the time. These wicks.
Was the ceiling concrete?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So it was in effect a tunnel situation.
Yeah, it was like a room about say 6 foot wide by about 6 foot high by about 20 foot long, and it's 2-3 spurs away that you went over, and then you come into the open gun pit, and you looked out there, and you looked over the wire in daylight. You could see the German position across there.
What about sleeping accommodation? Where was the sleeping accommodation?
Slept in this 20-foot dunes. There was wooden bunks, actually. Slept in there with wire mesh on. All we had were blankets. You had no mattress or nothing like that.
And latrines, what did you do for latrines?
The latrines, you had a 4-gallon petrol tin with the top cut off. And had a piece of wood with a hole cut in, you put it on the top. Now, you kept this in one of the dugouts, one of the gun pits. There was always a humorous part that was a duty at night when it got dark. One person used to climb out of the gun pit onto the top, and the other chap was down, and he'd lift the 4-gallon up of all the excreta and everything and give it to him up, and he'd empty it in there. You had an anti-tank trench right round your position, and he'd go and empty it in there. And I mean, that had been going on for years, well, not years, but a year, as you imagine. Anyway, I remember one night, the chap got up on the top. The other mate come along, and he had it half up, and the chap above was just going to reach down for it when he heard the buzzing of a mortar bomb. So he just dropped flat, and unfortunately the tin just collapsed all over. This chap was holding it up in the dunes, and he got covered in a lot of it. But that was a ritual. Every night you had to empty that. That was the routine.
And what about food? Was the cooking done in the same area?
We had a petrol blower thing. It's just like a petrol blow lamp. And it gives... You had to make a channel in the ground, put this in one end, and put things over and put the dixies on, and the heat used to go along, and that used to cook your food. We had a cook there, one of the lads is cooking. The Poles were near us, the Polish battalion was near us on the left of, we were on what they called the salient in Tobruk. It was like a valley and went up to the other side. Jerry was dug in on the top of there, about 3,000 yards away from us, looking across to us. I once went through on patrol through that area during the night, and we found burned out ambulances and all kinds in the dark with stretchers in this area. And according to the tales from the Poles, they said that there'd been a battle with the Australians at some time there, the Germans and the Italians, and they had a truce to collect the wounded and that from the valley. And during the truce, the Australians grabbed some of the German officers and started beating them up behind the positions. And, of course, the truce finished and everything was left as it was from that day. Well, I've seen the ambulances, but that's what they said happened. One of my jobs there is I had to go down to the company position, which this is a platoon position I'm talking about, a company position about 400 yards behind. I had to go every night. I had to go down in the dark to this. And I used, when I used to happen, I said, come out the dugout. And I knew the direction I had to go by the searchlights from the harbour and that. And on this, what had to be a bit of a path, I used to put pieces of wood pointing in the direction I had to go. And when I come back, I knew I'd follow them to come back to this position, because they were very small, the position to find, actually, in the dark. And I used to go down the company position, any messages, and then I used to get the password. And I had to bring the password back to the front line to tell our platoon people in case anybody came up or they went down. And the password was changed every night. Because I remember sometimes I used to go down there and I'd be stopped by the company headquarters to give the password, and it had been changed. And of course I didn't know it because I was going down to collect it. And there used to be all instances like that. Ardine used to love to come up to the front line, and you'd be in your gun position and you'd see somebody's shadow come up and you'd halt who goes there, and they carry on, halt, I'll fire, and you could see who it was. You knew it was the kid. And when he got to you, he played war with you. He says, you're supposed to fire when you don't get any answer. And he said, he was mad like that, mad man.
Was he well liked by the East?
Oh, yes, yes. He was a bit mad, but he didn't muck about with frills. He was a down-to-earth sort of man, As I say, Vaux was our CO, Huey Vaux. Second in command, Captain Summers Sanderson. Sanderson, I think it was. Sanderson.
Yeah. And who was your platoon leader?
We had a South African lieutenant in charge of our platoon. Canny bloke. I can't think of his name. Younger, something like that now, I think.
Had you a stripe at this time? Did you have stripes?
No. I never took stripes anymore after that. I didn't bother. I told him I didn't want them.
Do you recall your platoon NCOs?
We had a Cowell, a chap called Sergeant Cowell, Corporal Pereira, Sergeant Major Nicholson, who had big feet. We used to call them Feet Nicholson.
Were these good men? Were they good NCOs?
Oh yes, they were all regulars, from the battalion, first and second battalions. There was a marked difference I had the fortune to be in action with the regular battalion, that was the first battalion in the desert, and the territorial battalions in Normandy, and I seen a marked difference. The spirit was there, but the training, it was disgraceful, some of the things that happened.
Which, the territorials were less trained than the first?
Well, obviously they weren't. We had years of training and all the rest of it, and things that happened in Normandy was unbelievable. You couldn't believe some of the things that happened. But never mind.
Living in this platoon position that you were talking about, How did food come to you?
It came up. They had an agreement at night, about 8 o'clock at night. Trucks used to come up from battalion headquarters to the companies with food ration. Bring their hot dixies with food in, and bully beef, biscuits, McConaughey's. We had McConaughey's. I remember we had McConaughey. The first time I seen it, I think, was up there. Tea, they used to bring it up. Now there was an unwritten agreement for some reason. 8 o'clock at night, our trucks used to come up with the lights on, up to the front position. 3,000 yards away at Jerry Lines, you could see his trucks coming up with the lights on, and they were issuing, bringing the rations up, and of course we were bringing ammunition up as well. So were we, But it seems to be an unwritten, nobody shelled each other for that period. I don't know why. They just carried on and then it all petered down. And they brought the rations up and the cooks got them and prepared the meal. I think we got a pint of water per day and it was salty because it came from a small borehole in Tobruk and it supplied all Tobruk garrison and it was salty water. And you had to give the cook some of that for the cook and the meal and the rest was for you to keep yourself.
Can I ask you about what kind of meals were you getting?
Bully beef, biscuits. The one night, platoon cook, I forget now, we're in one position we're in, it wasn't his conk position, because we moved from the conky position, we moved to another one, and in a shell hole, big shell hole, this lad had had a net across the top, and he was volunteered for the platoon cook, and we had the bully beef and biscuits, and he got that religiously. A packet of biscuits between two and half a tin of bully beef between two. And that was religious. He got them. Now he says, I'll give you a change. He crushed the biscuits up and he was going to make a pie crust with this on the brazier thing. Unfortunately, there was a sandstorm came up during when he was making it and you couldn't see him, but he was still rolling this mixture. And he put it on top of a thing with bullion and put it in his little oven. And when it came out, you couldn't break the crust. It was like concrete with the sand that was mixed in with the whole lot. But he meant well.